welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And this is Brother Drew. Brother Drew today is played by...
Eric's hinky sock puppet.
By my sockless puppet.
Your sockless puppet. That's kind of creepy, actually.
You're looking at it the wrong way. That's Drew talking.
I see.
Anyway. Okay, I'm sorry. It's the All Bits episode of Not in a Creepy Way, because Drew is on vacation. I'm going to have the radio voice the entire program. Just because I know Drew would not appreciate it. So, it's, Weenie and the Butt.
Yeah, so did you look at that clip?
I did, so now tell me the context of Weenie and the Butt.
Well, it was because we were doing funny bits and you were throwing in funny soundboard attributes here and there, drop-ins of noises and snippets. And so it just harkens back to that Family Guy skit where it was like, Weenie in the Butt. And it's just the repetition and craziness of radio DJs. And you have a little bit of that in you.
Oh, of course. Yeah. The Morning Zoo. Waka waka.
Exactly. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It just... What you were doing made me chuckle and giggle and laugh and reminded me of that in a good way. Not in a creepy way.
Let's go to Ron on line two. Ron, you're live. Yes, Ron? Turn down your radio, Ron. Well, Ron's not going to join us tonight. Drew, isn't that disappointing? I'm very disappointed.
It's going to be a long night, isn't it?
It's true, yeah. If I'm going to do this all night. Okay, no, I'm not going to do this all night. So, basically, welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1988 film A Fish Called Wanda, directed by Charles Crichton. He also directed the Lavender Hill Mob and a whole bunch of movies throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. This is his last film.
Did he die?
He died eventually, but yeah, this is the last film he directed. Evidently, John Cleese sold this as a co-direction project, but he's like, oh no, I didn't do any of the directing on it. I just used my name so that we can get the director we wanted.
So we could get it funded.
Yeah, so.
Well, I mean, he had enough name pull, apparently.
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, it was sort of a Monty Python thing because you got two with the Pythons there, but it also had, like, hip folks from 1988.
It was an odd casting.
Yeah, it was, but it was fun though. I really enjoyed watching this movie again. Drew mentioned that he had bad memories of this movie, didn't particularly like it.
Yeah, because of the way the goldfish were treated.
Yeah, turns out the goldfish were treated just fine.
Yeah, because...
Although, not because of Kevin Kline, because apparently Kevin Kline would have happily eaten the goldfish, but they said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
What did you think about you picked this movie, so introduce us to this movie. How do you remember it, and how do you remember it now?
It was a high school movie high school movie for me. 88, I would have been right before, I think, right before or freshman year, right in there. So this is one of those movies that came out, and because we were Monty Python geeks, a couple of my clique, you know, anything that was Monty Python or Monty Python-ish, we would naturally gravitate towards. So, this became a movie that we obviously went and saw in the theater, and then immediately you know, once it was available on video, we rented it on video. And then when I was old enough to buy it on DVD, I have it on DVD because I have it on the no frills, bare bones, just straight DVD with the only extra feature is a fish tank screensaver.
I actually bought the movie for this viewing on iTunes because I couldn't find a Netflix copy in a hurry. And for some reason, I thought I already had it, but it turns out I did not. Oh. But it was well worth watching again. It was fun.
Yeah, it's got some great funny parts. It's also got some parts that you can identify have been stolen in later movies.
Oh, most definitely. And I'm sure that some of the comedy bits have been stolen from movies in the past. I mean, you know, this is like a caper film.
Yeah, I'm sure it's stolen by and stolen from in homage. I'm sure it's some kind of tribute.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure, yeah. I don't think anybody has dirty hands on this one. But, yeah, it was fun. It was just, you know, there's a couple of cringy things, like the main character, one of the main characters having a really bad stuttering problem, which you really couldn't get away with these days.
I think you could.
You think so?
I think so.
You don't think speech impediment groups would be all up in arms?
I think you would have to make him more of a hero role. If you portrayed him in a little bit more positive light and made him a little bit more of a hero role, I think you could get away with it.
Maybe. But other than that, though, I thought it was pretty great. I mean, there were some swear words in it, but really nothing too scandalous for these days, especially.
Because without him stuttering, some of the tension of the movie's gone because he's not, you know, if he's able to speak normally, then...
Yeah, he has to have some problem.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a disability. It could be just awkwardness, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it works fine. I mean, like I said, I stuttered as a kid. I wasn't upset about the portrayal of stuttering. I didn't instantly think, oh, because it turns out the guy does plenty of bad things. Some of which intentionally and most of which unintentionally.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the running joke of the movie because the movie opens with him being a big animal lover and being against animal cruelty. And one of the first things that happens is, you know, that it's kind of thrown in his face. And then immediately throughout the movie, he's trying to, you know, there's a subplot where he's trying to kill somebody. And instead of killing somebody, he's killing her pets, which, you know, is angsty for him because, you know, he really is upset when he kills the dogs, but he wants to kill the woman.
Oh, yeah, no, he's mortified. And, okay, so I guess we'll just dive into the plot. It's gonna, you know, as with comedies, we might not spend a whole lot of time talking about A Fish Called Wanda because you have to sort of experience the comedy of it. But our cast of characters are Ken Pyle, played by Michael Palin.
I think it's Palin.
Okay, well, Michael Palin, no relation, plays Ken Pyle, this stutterer who's an animal lover, and he's got a large tank of tropical fish. He has named his large angelfish Wanda after the sexy girlfriend of his flatmate George. George is played by Tom Georgeson, and this all takes place in London. So, of course, Michael Palin and... Tom Georgeson both have English accents. And later when we meet John Cleese and John Cleese's wife and John Cleese's daughter, who turns out is actually played by John Cleese's daughter, they all have English accents. But then we meet the aforementioned real Wanda, who's played by Jamie Lee Curtis, an American, and her brother, Otto, played by Kevin Kline, also an American. And I don't know about you. I don't know how much you know about or like. I think maybe I'm the only one in the family that really has a fierce love for Paul F. Tompkins. But all I saw was Paul F. Tompkins playing Otto in this.
I could not have sat through him in a movie.
Oh, get out. Mm-mm. You don't like Paul F.? Oh, well.
I like him in very small doses. He was on the Stephen Colbert... The Late Night with Stephen Colbert for a skit, which was marginally funny, but I don't like, just something about him I don't like. You know, it's not that I don't think he's funny, because sometimes he is, but there's just something about him that rubs me the wrong way. Kind of like Stephen Wright. I really like Stephen Wright's humor sometimes, but watching him is really off-putting for me.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. But yeah, well,
I know he's really talented and he's funny because lots of people think he's funny. So I'm in the minority, but just watching him, I just can't. Much like Chris Elliott.
Yes, much like Chris Elliott.
Like, I know Chris Elliott's talented and funny because lots of people think so, but I can't stand him.
Yeah, well, we all have those people.
Yeah, our father doesn't like Whoopi Goldberg, for instance.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that a new revelation?
No. He hasn't liked her for quite some time.
Oh, that's funny.
All those comic relief shows.
Oh, that's
funny. He hated sitting through her comedy. I think her comedy is quite funny. Her older comedy especially, but...
Well, her one-woman show is funny, but actually mostly sad.
Yeah.
So, that alt-comic thing.
Bucket of bleach.
Let's check in with Brother Drew. Brother Drew? Yes? Who is that person in your life that you can't deal with? Oh, it has to be Gina Davis. Gina. I hate Gina Davis. Well, thank you for being honest about that, because, you know... you always mention that her bad acting, but you just don't like her, isn't that the truth? Yes, I must confess. It is the total truth. Okay. Since I have to cut all this out, maybe I'll just knock this off. But
yeah. I don't know why you're going to cut it out. I think it's hilarious. I'm laughing. But,
yeah, well, I'm Paul F. Tompkins. I can't come up with the funny Drew voice.
I would suggest that the fact that he was really looking forward to listening to this episode because he wasn't in it, and then you mock him the whole time might be pretty counterclimactic for him.
Okay. Well, let's not have that.
Anticlimactic, I guess. Is okay. The better term.
All right.
I mean, I'm laughing every time you do it, but I'm an idiot.
Since Drew is actually on vacation, let's let him enjoy his vacation. You keep bringing him up, and I'm going to just stop you right now, because let's just dive into this movie that he doesn't like, and we'll talk about why he is wrong. I mean, we'll talk about why this movie is actually kind of fun.
Well, I think we can try and convince him maybe to watch it again on his own and kind of just give a off-the-cuff opinion. Because maybe when he saw it, he was in a place that was not so good, and he took the fish personally. Having raised aquarium fish in our parents' house may have had some influence. In the opening of the film, there's a lot of fish in his tank that we had in our tank. So
you think this is a deeply personal film? His version of Hair, maybe?
Perhaps. Although there was no, Well, I was going to say there was no genocide, but I guess there was a fish genocide, so maybe it is equivalent.
Well, yes, genocide is a little far on both movies, but yeah, there was definitely a mass slaughter.
Yeah.
So, we have this, again, we've seen a lot of heist movies, one actually called Heist, but, Snatch, and, we'll talk about Twilight, but... there's lots of like little heist caper movies that we've seen.
And then eventually Heat, right?
And then eventually Heat. Yes. Pretty soon, I think. Which is maybe the ultimate heist movie. But The Fish Called Wanda. Actually, I was surprised about two things. There's a style that I find really interesting. When they opened, were you struck by the fact that the titles kind of introduced everybody by photo? Like, they would do a freeze screen and put the or was it a freeze screen or just they no. showed the character and then showed the actors?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a very like almost like a TV show opening.
Almost. But that it was the 80s too, so I think that was kind of a pushy style at the time. It was very art housey kind of nouveau filmmaking.
And then we meet the characters right away, and then the heist is right away. I'd forgotten that.
Very instantaneously, almost immediately after the characters are introduced, you go right to the heist.
Yeah, and the heist goes fine. I mean, that's the fun part of this movie is there's no problem with the heist itself. You know, usually in a heist movie, you have tension during the actual heist. Nope, no tension here.
No, none at all.
Yeah, this goes great. They get exactly what they want, which is not, I guess, is it? Clear that they just want diamonds? Is that the point? They don't really talk too much about exactly what they're after.
They're not you're not really clear as to what they're after in the very beginning, and but as you see them kind of rooting through the bank vault that they've broken into, they're kind of eschewing some of the greater jewelry for more of the loose stones. So it appears that they're going for just loose stones.
Yeah. So they make off with this robbery. It's all very complicated but fun. And then they all go about their way, and they have to wait 72 hours because that's the rule in this movie, is that the police will lock down all transport for 72 hours until you have to lay low. So everybody plans to separate and lie low, except that this is where the treachery starts. Hold on. I'm sorry. On the way out, there is one slight hitch with the heist, and that's an elderly woman walking her three dogs sees the car as it's leaving. And so she can actually identify George, as it turns out.
Because the car almost runs her down. So exactly. She glares at George through the windshield, giving him the evil stink eye.
Yes. They lock eyes. And anyway. Almost immediately, though, we see there's some trickery going on, because after they put the loot in this safe in this like garage somewhere, immediately after everybody disbands, George comes back to the garage, doubles back, and at the same time, Otto and Wanda, who are supposed to be brother and sister but turn out to be actual lovers, they call up and tell the police that George did it. And I guess, so the whole idea is that they're going to tell him that George did it, go and steal the jewels, and then flee the country.
Yes.
So it's just this, it's just a simple double cross right there.
Yes.
But because George has now moved the jewels to a third location, now they have to start getting smarter.
And only he knows where that third location is.
Exactly. And of course, George is immediately, everybody is immediately suspicious of Otto, because Otto is like some sort of ex-CIA agent, but mostly he's just a jackwagon.
Well, he's supposed to be a CIA agent, but I think George very quickly thinks he's not. And being that he was introduced very quickly into the group, of course, the newest guy is always going to get blamed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And plus, he's an ugly American from the get-go.
Well, like, and he
drives
awful
on the wrong side of the road and screams asshole at other drivers.
And causes crashes of other people.
Yes, yes, all the time.
Also, in the one of the opening scenes of the movie before the heist, when they're introduced and they're sitting in the living room, he starts mocking kind of Ken for his stutter, and then immediately was showing George his talents. And throws his knife into the, I just stuttered there. Is that crazy?
Yeah.
He throws his knife into the poster of the seal.
Yes.
Which, of course, Ken just loses it.
Yeah, he's horrified. So, yeah. So Otto thinks Ken is hilarious because he stutters and he's an animal lover, and yet he's supposed to be part of this big gang. So, so we have this whole weird, all the sex in this movie is very strange. Like, there's not really any nudity. There's some
save
like
John Cleese's
shots.
Ass.
Yeah, there's John Cleese, and then there's some lingerie posing by Jamie Lee Curtis. But otherwise, it's kind of slapstick sex.
So to speak.
Well, yeah. Some people pay extra for that. Our mom listens to this. Don't talk about slapstick.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah. It's hot. What do you think, Drew?
I think we need to move on with the plot now.
It's very wise of you. I don't know why Drew probably has the deepest voice of all of us. I don't know why I'm giving him the...
I don't know why you're Kermit the Frog treatmenting him.
Hi-ho, Drew the engineer here.
Yeah, you're exactly Kermit the Frogging him is really what you're doing.
So George is arrested and implicated in the crime. And he has particles of like broken glass on one of his trouser legs because of the jewelry heist.
Because he had to go to the further step of beyond just shooting the ceiling out, he had to kick the glass of the bank vault area just to be a dick.
Yeah. So, yeah, George turns out is the serious, like, dickish one of them.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of comedy in George.
No, he's very serious. He seems to be very professional-ish about his thievery, but not so professional that he ends up getting involved with, you know, a girlfriend and her sketchy brother, who is a virtual unknown. So for somebody who's supposed to be a professional, he's not really all that professional.
Well, no, and he does trust Ken, so much so that George ends up meeting with Ken and gives him a very small key, which is supposed to be a safety deposit box key. Maybe that's what European safety deposit box keys look like, but it seems like American safety deposit box keys are much bigger.
Well, you know, Americans have to have everything bigger and uglier.
I suppose, so.
But, you know, you figure in the times of, like, Swiss banks and things like that, you wanted small, discreet keys that you could hide in secret away easily.
Oh, maybe. Well, Ken is going to hide this key in a very safe place inside the aquarium in the treasure chest. But Wanda sees Ken hiding this and then immediately steals the key and hides it in her locket.
Well, this is after, though, that Otto and Wanda find out by going back to the garage that the jewels have actually been moved.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, they find out the jewels have been moved, so they're not happy at all.
Because Otto has that very disappointed scream, which is ripped off by Gary Oldman later in The Fifth Element.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even notice that.
If you listen to it, they are very similar.
Kevin Klein does a really great job. Him is, you know, his portrayal of Otto is over the top, but really fun. I bet you he had a fun time playing.
Well, he plays unhinged very well. There's a part in the movie later on, which I'm going to spoil now, where he's driving in the car back to Archie's house. He's like, I'm sorry. And then he's like, fuck you. And I must have rewound that on my DVD player, I don't know, 4 or 5 times, because it was so funny.
Oh, yeah.
It's still funny. It makes me laugh. And it's so stupid. And yet his delivery is so perfect, because you can just see the conflict in him. Like, he wants to apologize to be good, but then he's, you know, the rage in him's like, you know, no, this dude's a douche. Not realizing the irony that he is actually the biggest douche of all.
Exactly, yeah, and completely unhinged. And not the smartest guy in any room that he's in.
Probably not.
But, you know, we have basically very broad characters. I mean, we have, you know, so Otto is a lunatic. And Wanda is like a seductress. She actually, I think she has a kissing scene with every male in the movie.
That's true.
Except maybe for, she maybe does have one, George. It's in the beginning, she's George's girlfriend.
She kisses George repeatedly and gets groped by him.
Yeah, because, so she has a romantic scene with everybody in this movie, which is hilarious. And, of course, Otto is super jealous. And then we have Ken, who's kind of, he's kind of our bumbling character. Like, he's the hooker with the heart of gold. He's not a hooker, but, you know, he's the animal lover kind of bumbling guy. And then we meet John Cleese. And John Cleese is the barrister representing George. And he is a married man who lives in a nice estate. And he has like an adult or nearly adult daughter. And they are very wealthy, but it turns out only because of his wife. And he is, you know, like, he's just a lawyer. He's not necessarily particularly good or particularly bad. But he's sort of the middle-aged guy that's in, you know, is ripe for the plucking for Jamie Lee Curtis's seductress character.
Yeah. He's happy with his life until he realizes that he's actually unhappy.
Exactly. Yeah, because his wife is kind of a shrew. And, you know, so he's kind of, and because he's English, he's not, you know, he's much more reserved. So mm-hmm. His life isn't as exciting as he probably imagines it could be.
He talks later in the movie about how he's always unhappy and uptight, and that's how the British are. They're always worried about being improper.
Yeah. Well, and you know, so we have that, and he is the character who is, I guess, like our only normal person in the movie.
He's the untainted individual who ends up being fully tainted by the end of the movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, because, you know, he actually, in little increments, but, you know, fairly quickly, he, you know, Wanda gets her way, because that's what she does, and so there's this elaborate, you know, scenes of him going to the house while the wife is away, and he ends up, Wanda drops her locket that has the key in it, and the wife, whose name is Wendy, gets a hold of it, and it's got a W on it, so, you know... It's all like normal comedy shenanigans, trying to get the locket back and trying to get... Oh, the plan, by the way, is they assume that George is going to plead guilty, but then offer up the location of the gems to reduce his sentence, and he'll give up the gems to the lawyer, and so they'll basically knock off the lawyer for the gems. Is that about right?
Yes.
So, again, this is all none too subtle, and but... You know, there's lots of funny things that ensue. But one of the things they have to do is, in the meantime, so we've got Otto and Wanda trying to work on the lawyer, Archie, John Cleese, because they assume that George is going to plead guilty. Well, George is not going to plead guilty. He talks to Ken and basically tells Ken to kill the only witness, this old lady.
Who identified him, by the way, in a lineup in which she is face-to-face with all of the men in the lineup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Very and different.
And by the way, she is supposed to be old and in ill health.
She has a heart condition.
So they make it a point of it. They want to accelerate the trial because she might not live through a long delay in the trial. So that's that way they have to knock her off.
Dramatic tension.
Yes. And when Otto finds out that Ken is going to try to go knock her off, he openly mocks him, which is kind of a funny scene.
This is after he made, you know, his homosexual advance at Ken, well, where he tries to pretend that he really secretly in love with Ken and wants to be a couple. Because when he confronts Ken about killing the old lady, he shouts out on the street like, look at that butt. That's mine. Don't anybody look at that. That's mine. Which is hilarious.
Yeah, I kind of forgot that scene. I kind of yada yada past where when Ken comes home. And where they find the key, Ken also discovers that Otto and Wanda are, like, in the bedroom together as Wanda has just gotten out of the shower. So they have to, you know, this is all looks very, very strange for somebody who's supposed to be brother and sister. So that way Otto has to have
some misdirection.
Yeah, like, totally misdirect Ken. So tries to seduce Ken in the most silly way possible. And Ken, being English, has to, you know, he has to be very polite.
He has that very painful grin, like, you know, like he's trying to be polite, but he doesn't know how to get away without being rude. And he's like, trapped. And so he just keeps backing away.
Exactly. He's like, there must be some misunderstanding. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but no, thank you. And of course, Otto is just way over the top about, you know. Yeah. Just a little kiss.
He's laying it on pretty thick.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah. So automatically Ken, it shrinks, physically shrinks away from him, which is funny. And then, of course, when Otto's making a big deal about it outside the courthouse, in front of all the just passersby, it's pretty funny. So, in the meantime, we have, you know, of course, Wanda ends up, as I mentioned before, Wanda ends up at Archie's house to try to seduce Archie, but she ends up dropping the locket. Also, the wife, Wendy, and the daughter come home because there's a flat tire on their car. And Otto has hung around, and he's like the lookout, but he's also super jealous of Archie because when Wanda explains to Otto, is this where the scene where they talk about how far they're going
to
go?
In the car on the ride over to the house about what he's, you know, he's interrogating her as to what she's going to do.
Yes.
And she says, well, I think, you know, there's going to be fondling of my boobs because, you know, $13 million, it's worth some boob fondling.
Yeah.
You know, So they have, yes, they have a kind of a negotiated discussion as to what Ken feels is, I'm sorry, what Otto feels is appropriate. He's like, well, you can do anything, and just if, you know, if you touch his dick, I'll kill him.
Yes, exactly. So, and by the way, of course, Wanda is the adult, the only adult in this, the group of heisters.
Yeah, she's she just keeps putting Otto into his place, as it were, and trying to make him realize she's going to do whatever it takes to get the diamonds, up to and including, you know, fully sleeping with Archie if she has to.
Oh, exactly. That's her tools to work with.
Although, no pun intended.
Yeah.
I think she will sleep with anybody and attempts to repeatedly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She would have slept with the old lady and all the dogs. Yeah.
And as long as they spoke Italian or apparently Russian to her.
Yeah, any kind of foreign accent is.
And, of course, all of Kevin Kline's Italian is like recipes and dictators.
It's hilarious. Yeah.
It's very funny.
Yeah, and actually a lot of John Cleese's Russian is the same. So, yeah, it's pretty funny. And so I like that. I mean, the whole, again, this is kind of a slapstick broad comedy. It's great. There's a scene where Otto has to come in and kind of save Archie and Wanda from the wife finding out. And then we have the later scene where... Wanda's going to seduce Archie at a different location and doesn't tell Otto, but Otto follows her anyway. And that ends with the famous scene of Otto demanding that Archie apologize and Archie suggesting that wasn't going to happen. And then we see Otto dangling Archie off the building, Suge Knight fashion.
Yeah. Also, is Archie kind of an odd name for a British dude? I mean, I don't know a lot of British guys, but when I think Archibald and Archie, I just don't think British.
I don't know. I of course, when I think of Archie.
Then so that's what I think, too.
Yeah.
I think that may be our generation.
Probably. It's because our father was Archie.
In many ways.
Yes.
Not the racist ways, just the geez.
Yeah, so we have a lot of shenanigans, and again, like, I don't know, think we have to necessarily break down all this comedy. You know, it ends up with lots of slapstickery and twists and turns, and all along, I guess we should spoil the fact that all along, Ken is charged with killing this woman, and he, one by one, manages to... not kill her, but kill each of her dogs one by one as he injures himself fairly significantly, worse and worse every time.
Yeah. And at one point when he's in the dreadlocks driving the car, I was dying. I thought it was so funny. It was just so ridiculous. And yet I laughed. But by the third dog, when he squished the third dog and the old lady is like still pulling the leash, not realizing the dog is stationary under this cement block that's fallen, I could not breathe. I was laughing so hard.
Well, it's pretty great because, you know, he's horrified all this long, and when she finally has a heart attack and dies with the third dog, he actually walks over and he's just so, like, dementedly delighted. He's like, ah! Which, you know, is appalling.
It's actually pretty funny. I mean, it's a great scene.
Oh, yeah.
Comedy genius.
Of course, then we have after Otto has to go apologize to Archie for dangling him out of the window. There's all a misunderstanding there too. There's, like, of course, misunderstanding parts of this comedy. It's a little Three's Company there. But Wendy finds out that Archie is at least trying to be unfaithful.
Well, after the scene in which Archie tries to rob his own house to get the locket back.
Yes, and he gets hit in the head with, like, a bedpan or whatever that is.
I think it's a bed warmer.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Bedpan. No, well, bed warmer. Bedpan would not be something you just hang on your door.
I guess you wouldn't have a big stick on the bedpan.
I guess it depends on...
Yeah. Anyway.
Never mind.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's fine. I don't even have to give away the ending necessarily. I mean, do we really need to drop the rest of it? I just say, if you haven't seen A Fish Called Wanda,
go watch it.
See it.
It's cute. Fun.
Yeah. Yep. Did you know that this movie, a documented case, this movie caused someone to die?
Oh, dear. Why?
His name was Ole Benson. He was a Danish audiologist. And died.
Danish audiologist is already funny.
Yes. He died while watching the scene of Kevin Klein putting the potatoes in Michael Palin's nose. As he was laughing, his heart was beating somewhere between 200 and 500 times a minute before he went into cardiac arrest.
500? How do they know that?
This is one of those things where they thought it was an urban legend, but it turns out like Snopes tracked this down too, and this is like a for real thing.
Your heart cannot beat 500 times a minute.
I'm just saying that this is what is documented. I don't know this to be true.
If he's dead, how could they document it? Well, yeah, there's no evidence, though. They say that his heart got there, but you would have to be hooked up to a monitor to know. Otherwise, the 500, your heart muscle is not physically capable of that. So I just call shenanigans.
Okay, so the story behind the Ole Benson story was that he had made a joke a few years earlier with his family during dinner, where he put a piece of cauliflower up his and every member's family member's nose as a joke, and made a bet with them about who could eat up their carrots without the cauliflower falling out. This, by the way, be careful who you go to dinner with in Denmark. So when the scene with Ken and the chips came up, he started thinking about this dinner incident and laughed so hard that his heart stopped. The story is well known in Scandinavia and spread around as an almost urban legend. Mm-hmm. It was confirmed by his son, though, who said that it was also who was also told the dinner story as an explanation to why his father laughed so hard during the chip scene and he died. He died in the theater.
Fastest recorded heartbeat on record is only 480, and that was at severe distress and amphetamine. So I don't know.
Okay.
I don't doubt that he died from laughing, but the rate at which they're claiming is, I think, hyperbole to a degree. But, you know, I'm sure it was good publicity for the movie.
Yeah. By the way, do you know why John Cleese chose the name of Archie Leach?
Because that was, yes, it was somebody's real name.
Cary Grant's birth name.
Cary Grant's birth name. I knew that. I had forgotten it.
Yep. So, that's pretty funny. Apparently Michael Palin's father stuttered so that, Michael used a lot of his real experience, including the fact that his stutter was less pronounced around people he trusts. But what I thought was funny is at the end when John Cleese was trying to get him to, John Cleese was trying to get him to sing. Like, yeah. Sing it so you won't stutter.
It was hilarious.
It was so funny because I kind of laughed despite myself because I was thinking, well, this stuttering thing has gone on far too long and is kind of, you know, non-politically correct. But they were just so into it, so funny that it's just, you know, it's like Carol Burnett kind of comedy.
Well, just also, it helps to exemplify that Otto's a dick because he mocks it more and more at the, you know, towards the end of the movie. One of my most favorite lines in the movie is, you know, Kevin Klein mocking Otto's, Otto mocking Ken's stuttering, you know.
Like at the very end, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, look, it's Ken coming to kill me.
So, and I mean, never has somebody been run over by a steamroller to probably the loud cheers in the audience.
Well, in the comedy that it's the world's slowest steamroller.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
You know, it's there's so many layers of funny. I mean, it is so hilarious to watch.
Well, there's a couple other kind of things that were hilarious. First of all, the fish that Kevin Klein eats were made entirely out of gelatin. Klein claims that he offered to eat real live fish, but the filmmakers wouldn't let him.
Yeah, that would have been...
So it shows how much of a monster Kevin Klein is.
Well, you suffer for your art, right?
Yeah, yeah. I guess the first dead dog scene They use like entrails from a butcher's, like scattered around the dead dog, and the preview audiences were so horrified that it was reshot and that it's obviously a fake stuffed animal. Yeah.
I actually kind of appreciate that because it makes me, it doesn't take me out of the movie and makes me not hate them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because normally in a movie, if the dog dies, I'm done.
The hymn that the choir boys sing at the dog's funeral. I'm not going to say the hymn, but it translates directly into English from Latin as have mercy, Lord, the dog is dead. Let's see. Yeah, so we mentioned that Cynthia Cleese played Portia, Archie's daughter. So, yeah, I think thank you for putting this on the calendar. I definitely needed, again, maybe some more of kind of like a sorbet between the what turned out to be like the long road, long good but long road of Terminators, followed by the very angry making Secret of Nim. So we need a little sorbet before we get to, I think next week is Miller's Crossing.
Oh God!
Another comedy gem.
Oh yeah.
So it should be a good movie, but it should be a different seeing experience.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else on Fish Called Wanda before we move on to other business?
It was a totally 80s movie, though, from the synth and the bass and the twangy music. It was totally 80s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, completely. It
was all 80s cheesiness. It was good, though.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me a little bit of like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah, but...
You know, that kind of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly not the... like the, was it Seth Rogen kind of comedies of today, or the Adam Sandler comedies, but more of the, yeah, kind of more pure.
Well, and this movie made a crap ton of money.
Oh yeah, yeah, and actually Kevin Kline won an Academy Award for this movie.
See, that I find ridiculous. I find that just ridiculous. Whoever, I don't know who else was up that year, but it just seems ridiculous.
You don't think so?
I don't know. What else was up that year? Alec Guinness for Little Dorrit, River Phoenix for Running on Empty, Martin Landau for Tucker, Kevin Kline for A Fish Called Wanda, and Dean Stockwell for Married to the Mob.
Wow, that was a weak year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, hold on. Okay, hold on. Let's check out this. Actor in leading role, Max von Sydow for Pele the Conqueror, Edward James Olmos for Stand and Deliver, Tom Hanks for Big, Gene Hackman for Mississippi Burning, but the winner was Dustin Hoffman for Rain Man. Dustin Hoffman for Rain Man. Best actor in a leading role... Nominated were Sigourney Weaver, Gorillas in the Mist, Meryl Streep, A Cry in the Dark, Melanie Griffith for Working Girl, Glenn Close for Dangerous Liaisons, but the winner, Jodie Foster for The Accused. Actress in a supporting role. The nominees are Sigourney Weaver for Working Girl, Michelle Pfeiffer for Dangerous Liaisons, Frances McDermott for Mississippi Burning, Joan Cusack for Working Girl, but the winner, Gina Davis for The Accidental Tourist.
Drew's favorite.
Ba-da-da. Calm down, Drew. Best Picture. Nominated were Working Girl, Mississippi Burning, Dangerous Liaisons, The Accidental Tourist, and the winner, Rain Man. Directing, also won by Rain Man.
Rain Man was a pretty good movie.
Never seen it.
Wow. We need to watch it. That's a great movie.
We can put it on the list. Never seen it. Winner for makeup, Beetlejuice. Beat Coming to America and Scrooged.
what an odd lineup.
That's okay. Sound effects editing, won by Who Framed Roger Rabbit, beating Die Hard and Willow.
God, what a weird year that was.
Let's see. Original screenplay. Winner is Rain Man over Big, Bull Durham, Fish Called Wanda, and Running on Empty. adapted screenplay, Dangerous Liaisons, beating Accidental Tourist, Gorillas in the Mist, Little Dorrit, and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Let's see. The winner in Best Original Song was
For a Working Girl?
Yes. Let the Liver... sorry.
Red Leather, Yellow Leather.
Let the River Run. Musical lyrics by Carly Simon. Oh, the documentary feature winner was Hotel Terminus, The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie.
Oh, God.
Yes.
All right.
Well. Best music original score was Dave Grushin for the Milagro Beanfield War.
Oh, jeez.
Which, actually, I thought that movie was sweet. That was one I watched with our grandmother. Okay, so 1989 was an interesting year. I think, wasn't that one of Drew's influential years for music?
I think 88, he said.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well.
89, though. That's pretty close. Do you have the 6 degrees of 2001?
I do. I have the 6 degrees of 2001. Hold on. I thought. Because, as it turns out, while Drew requested 6 degrees of something else, like Take Shelter, the music cue, I don't have a music cue for Take Shelter.
I know. That was.
So that's the best part of it.
Yeah, the whole bit falls apart.
Yeah. So I'm going to continue to do this bit as long as I can drag it out.
Yeah, I think you should do it forever. But I think he should do, you know, he should do it. And then we have to pick a movie for me to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then we all have a shtick.
Exactly. Well, he doesn't like bits, so... who said, don't talk for me? I'll let you talk for yourself. Thank you. That's all I ask.
We need to buy him the Gina Davis collection for Christmas.
We need to buy him the Gina Davis...
fan club membership?
No, I was thinking like the live bronze bust.
Newsletter?
Oh, my God.
Fan club?
The Gina Davis, oh no, we need to get him on the mailing list for the Gina Davis Foundation for Women in Media.
Well, but that's mean because he wouldn't be able to turn that down.
Well, exactly. He has daughters. It's important. Yeah. So anyway.
And a wife.
Yes. So 6 degrees. A Fish Called Wanda, starring Jamie Lee Curtis. Who is in 1980's The Fog with Adrian Barbeau. Who is in 1984's The Next One with Keir Dullea. Who is Dr. Dave Bowman in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
The Fog. I had forgotten about that movie.
Oh, that's a John Carpenter movie, and I think John Carpenter was married to Adrian Barbeau at the time.
I remember that not being a terrible movie.
No, it's fine. I mean, you know, it's kind of a goofy horror movie, but not too bloody if I remember.
Yeah.
And had good ambiance. And again, it was one of those radio station movies, much like Pontypool. Yeah. Have you seen Pontypool yet?
I haven't.
Okay. Oh, you should. It's fun. It's goofy as shit at the end, but it's fun. So, okay. So, shall we...
did you want to discuss our recasting of A Fish Called Wanda?
Sure. Let's do that. Here is my... If I have it handy, I certainly hope I do.
If you don't, I do. Okay. So, you have for Archie, you put Simon Pegg. For Wanda, you have Jennifer Love Hewitt.
For some reason, I just saw Jennifer Love Hewitt. I don't know why.
Wendy, you put Emily Blunt / Natalie Imbruglia.
I think Natalie needs some work.
Okay. For Otto, you cast Paul F. Tompkins.
Yes.
For Ken, you got Chris Elliott. Bastard. And for George, you got Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, that was my recruit at work. Because I basically said to her, who's an actor who's not too old that looks good in a suit? She goes, Ryan Gosling. I'm like... Like, okay. Is Ryan Gosling looks good in anything. I'm like, okay.
So, probably out of anything, too.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
So, my recasting was that I put Archie as Louis C.K., Wanda as Maya Rudolph, Wendy as Natalie Portman, Otto as Sacha Baron Cohen, Ken as Eddie Izzard, and George as Craig Ferguson.
Yeah, see, okay, I really like the idea of Otto being Sacha Baron Cohen, and I really like Craig Ferguson, and what was the last one?
Well, Craig Ferguson was the last one.
Well, who's before
Sacha Eddie Baron? Izzard as Ken.
Eddie Izzard, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Although I think Eddie Izzard could also play Archie.
Or Wanda or Wendy.
Well, that's true, yeah. Yeah, I don't really see Louis C.K. I don't really like Louis C.K., frankly.
Yeah, but he's kind of the good straight man where he could play the attorney and the clueless kind of bungling oaf.
Yeah, but what about Jim Gaffigan?
He would also be good. He would be good.
Yeah. So, yeah, excellent. I like it. I like it a lot. I think that's better. I pick Simon Pegg because he could speak English.
Simon Pegg would be good too, because he would be a good Archie. So I agree with that. He'd probably be a better Archie than Louis C.K. But I wasn't sure if we wanted to do all American. But I cast Maya Rudolph because I think she'd be the perfect Wanda, because she could be the American and, you know, be the seductress. And I could imagine her being the crazy linguistic freak.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I was trying to think who was the equivalent of Jamie Lee Curtis. And I settled on Jennifer Love Hewitt because she's suitably cute and has been in lots of comedies that kind of work.
Well, I mean, for that matter, you could have done like Amy Poehler or Tina Fey, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of talent that is just, you know.
Yeah.
There's plenty of pool to draw from there.
Yeah. Well, it has to be somebody that is fairly attractive but not stunning. Like, you couldn't have an Angelina Jolie or a like Sofia Vergara, or, you know, it has to be somebody who is like more like all American kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
the girl even next door type.
Like an Amy Adams could work.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, so yeah, no, I thought this was fun. Now, on to the next topic.
Yes.
Do we want to discuss your new favorite podcast? Well, second favorite podcast.
Let's do this. Let's do the second favorite podcast, because we'll give them a free plug.
Yeah, absolutely.
But because everybody knows, or maybe everybody doesn't know, I'm a huge West Wing fan. I have been. I own all 7 seasons on DVD. It's on Netflix, so I don't have to watch it on DVD. And I have probably once a year, I restart it and watch all of it from start to finish. Not in a day or anything, but I will go through stages where I will just binge 5 or 6 episodes a night, like on a Friday night, just watch 5 or 6 episodes. And burn through the series, because it's highly watchable. It's very funny. And even though I've seen it, it's still funny. And the writing is so great and crisp. And the dialogue is so fast and punchy. And it's topical, and sometimes it's prescient. That, you know, I adore The West Wing. Seasons 5 and 6 get a little rough. But, you know, I'm a completionist, so watch it from start to finish. But now Josh Molina and I'm going to forget his name. Josh Molina from The West Wing, who played Will Bailey, and another podcaster, have created the West Wing Weekly, which is basically they're going through all the episodes one by one, and they're podcasting about them. And they're actually going through it, and I think last week's episode, they actually had Dulé Hill, who played Charlie Young, actually had him on the podcast. So if you're a West Wing fan like me, and you dig, they're going through the episodes one by one, so you can start watching and then go and download the podcast. And so they're going to keep doing this. So far, I think they're, I don't know how many episodes they're up to. I think they're on the 4th episode. So I'm actually really enjoying it. So,
well, and that is awesome because, you know, this is kind of what podcasts are really good for. Like Camille Nanjiani really kind of set an interesting precedent. He wasn't the first, and of course he's not the last, but he took on the X-Files, and, you know, due to him taking on the X-Files, they actually did the new X-Files, you know, that short run they did, because he managed to you know, capture all the you know, from a fan's point of view, but also get people who were involved in it in the podcast itself. So if you were a fan, you could really, you know, cheese out on it, but at the same time, you know, just like learn things, you know, if you weren't around then, if you don't remember it, you can listen about how people who watched things on TV, you know, how they watched TV at that time, because now people don't watch TV the same way. And also how they use the internet and how the writers thought about things and how the network screws things up or doesn't, or how, you know, actors moving on will screw things up or doesn't. I think the podcast as a medium is really good for that sort of thing. Well, and now I know why you didn't mention Josh Molina's co-host, because you can't pronounce his name.
Oh, well.
It's Rishikesh Hirway, maybe?
I don't know.
He's from the Song Exploder podcast.
Yeah, I mean, he's a huge West Wing fan. The thing I'm also really enjoying is that because Josh Molina is friends with Aaron Sorkin, he's got some of the inside dirt or inside stuff on Aaron Sorkin. And so, you know, he's got some real insight as to some of the dialogue in the episodes and why things happen the way they do and stuff like that. So, you know, part of it is that we'll also get some information that maybe, you know, we were wondering about as watchers and lovers of other Aaron Sorkin vehicles, not the least of which is, you know, that there's a scene in The West Wing that is paralleled by a scene in The American President, which is also a Sorkin flick. And basically there was a throwaway scene from American President that Sorkin used in West Wing.
Well, okay, do the Sorkin vehicles, do they all exist in the same world? There's not like a continuous thread between all the Sorkin things, right?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. But no. There's lots of little nuggets in there.
Sure.
Because that's what you do. You reuse stuff, you know?
Although Josh Molina is in a lot of them.
True. In fact, he actually, I think if I'm reading this quick scan of this Entertainment Weekly article, he suggests that Sorkin actually stole a story from Molina's life.
It's possible.
Yeah, which makes sense because, you know, that's, you're writing about, you know, interesting characters.
Well, and you find interesting stories amongst reality. That's the best thing to write, because if it's from reality, it's, you know, everybody can identify with it. It's relatable.
Yeah, it's the Everybody Loves Raymond Phil Rosenthal rule.
Right. So if it's relatable, it's going to be popular.
Yeah.
And he also suggests, Josh Molina suggests, Aaron Sorkin, when he finds an actor he likes, he becomes comfortable with them, and he likes to recast them because he's comfortable with them.
Yeah, well, and which also makes sense. I mean, you know, you want to work with people that are good to work with.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So that's just my little thing. I really dig in the West Wing Weekly Plus. I get to go and it gives me an excuse to just rewatch, which is great anyway.
Yeah. So, no, I haven't listened to it, but it's going to be on my list because absolutely.
Yeah,
and it turns out I am temporary custodian of our grandmother's West Wing box set, so I can avail myself to that.
Well, it's also Netflix streaming, so.
Well, excellent. So everybody can watch it.
Yeah. You can stream. But I think the episodes vary anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. So really, it varies based from week to week. But I'm enjoying it. Of course, I listen to us first, but.
Of course, yes. Well, and I know my daughter likes Can I Pet Your Dog better than our podcast, but that's okay because our podcast really isn't meant for children.
Right.
Also, she likes Stop Podcasting Yourself, too. But I took the clip where Journey says her favorite podcast is Can I Pet Your Dog, and I sent it to the Can I Pet Your Dog people.
Yeah.
And they got a kick out of it, so that's fun.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So when she's dating, it'll be good to embarrass her with.
Yeah. So she hates to listen to, like, if I'm editing and I play like that little part with her, she did not want to hear that at all. She's like, stop it. Never. She says,
yeah. Well, but in her defense, we were the same way as kids.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
I mean, no, and recording,
are you kidding? We were the same way the first week we recorded the podcast. Because nobody, you know, before I did the job that I do now that requires everything I do be taped, I didn't like my voice. I'm just barely tolerating it now.
Yeah. No, it was hard to listen the first week. So, yeah. I mean, recording German videos for German class and then playing them in class and having to sit in class while they're played was the most excruciating reality I'd ever experienced, because I thought this would be great extra credit. This is great extra credit for my class. I'll do this. And then as it was unfolding, I was like, I'm never doing this again.
You need to send me one of your German videos so I can just put a clip in there.
Oh, no.
That would be great.
No. Nope. I don't even have a copy, I don't think, at this point. It's on VHS. It's probably way too degraded if I do.
Oh, so this is like old-time German class. Okay, this wasn't like recently at any point.
Oh, no. This is like 7th grade.
Okay, all right. So this was, yeah. This was like something like 35 years ago.
This would have been, well.
Not quite.
No, sorry. It would have been 1989, 88, 89. So, I mean, you do the math how old that is.
Okay, so that would be like 27 years ago.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, darn. Sorry.
Okay, so shall we move on to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yes.
Okay, so you sent me a very interesting Facebook news headline story, and I actually took the time. I didn't TLDR it. I actually read the whole article.
Yeah.
And you asked me to just comment, and you want to set up the you sent me the Black Keys response to the Steve Miller outburst
at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And so let me preface this with, I hadn't heard of the Black Keys when they were up and coming. And it was actually Brother Drew who said, hey, I think you'd really like this. And he gave me the CD when I was in Anchorage. And I got the CD, and I think I played it in my car for like every day for probably the better part of a month. Really dug it. I really did. So I became kind of an overnight Black Keys fan. And I kind of did I started some investigation of them and saw some other projects, because they've got some independent projects going on, and got a video of one of their productions. It was pretty, I immersed myself in the universe that was the Black Keys. So I'm aware of them as a band. I'm aware of them independently in their own side projects. And I think they're great. I mean, I don't think they're the best band for me in the world, but I understand why a lot of people love them, and of course I love them. So when I saw this article, I thought, I didn't understand the title of the article when I read it. Sometimes things are worded poorly these days in the press because I think people have lost editing abilities. So when I read the title, I was a little confused. So I actually had to read the article, and as I was reading the article, I was horrified for them.
Okay, so tell the story of what happened from their point of view.
Well, they were to induct Steve Miller and the Steve Miller Band into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so they were really looking forward to the experience because they were huge fans of Steve Miller. And so here they were, you know, here you are, one of your fellow musical heroes, if you will. And you get to present them to what you think is a big award, which personally would have been, if they were being inducted, would have been a huge award for them too. So they get it. So they present this award, and then Steve Miller has this crazy ranting anti-establishment corruption artist stifling, just this crazy old man screaming at the sky rant. And it really kind of, you know, I think he said I've forgotten his name, but I think the singer, the lead singer from the Black Keys.
Dan Auerbach,
yeah. So Dan Auerbach was really kind of hurt and disappointed that that Steve Miller didn't seem to be aware of who they were as a band, which he said, you know, I get it. That's fine. But it's still kind of painful and disappointing, but it's okay. But it was so painful, I guess, his ranting, that after that, they just kind of left. They were just done. And they didn't hang out. They didn't want to do anything else there because it was just kind of too hurtful. And so I think that's, for me, that was a really kind of powerful, and I think you and I have discussed, if not, I've discussed this with other people, it's kind of the Van Morrison syndrome, where Van Morrison is a great singer-songwriter. He's a great artist. I enjoy Van Morrison. Our parents have a great love for Van Morrison, but as a person, he seems to be a little bit reprehensible. He seems to hate his audiences, it seems to be temperamental and storms out of performances and just pretty much doesn't want to play any of the old songs because he thinks that people should listen to the new stuff. And, you know, the old stuff is old stuff and people need this. You know, it's like he's lost sight of why he started making music in the first place. And he lost sight of the fact that the audience is who made him who he was and gave him the freedom to be on stage. And so it makes me wonder if Steve Miller is that out of touch as well, that the audience gave him the ability to be up on that stage and make that rant, and the irony that, you know, being inducted into the very thing that put him where he's at. So it's just disappointing.
Yeah. Well, and I was disappointed too. When I read that, I was disappointed, and then I did some digging.
Well, and so that's what I'm looking forward to. But and I have to also say, I'm not a huge Steve Miller fan. So, yeah. You know, that part doesn't bother me. I'm like, I mean, Steve Miller, I grew up with Steve Miller music playing in the background, but I was never a big Steve Miller fan because it just seemed like hippie pothead music. Yeah, he is, I think, the what would be the modern day equivalent Dave Matthews.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, well, I have a whole different relationship with Dave Matthews, as you know, because you were there.
Yes.
So, okay, so listen, this is what I learned. And by the way, this is not, I didn't intend this to be a complete, like, rebuttal of the Black Keys, but it's going to turn into a little bit of that.
Well, and that's fine, because, you know, as I said, it was just an article I read, and so.
Yeah, well, it was definitely worth. It was interesting because it made me do. First of all, I really listened. One of my favorite podcasts, besides "Can I Pet Your Dog," is "Never Not Funny," Jimmy Pardo's podcast. And Jimmy Pardo and one of his best friends, Pat Francis, who Pat Francis does some sort of like rock and roll podcast that I don't happen to listen to. But if you listen to episode 1809 of "Never Not Funny," Jimmy Pardo and Pat Francis talk about going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it's very interesting because just the road to getting to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as just a guest is one thing. But they got some access that they wouldn't have gotten if they were just ticket holders. They actually went as press representatives of the AV Club. So they had a little more access. And both of them are big fans. Like, Jimmy Pardo's favorite band, and he was actually in the documentary about this band, is Chicago. And he's been, like, to 90 Chicago concerts or whatever. So he knows, like, the band members of Chicago. And then Pat Francis' favorite band is Cheap Trick. And so both Chicago and Cheap Trick were inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. So that's why they decided they had to go. And, of course, it cost them a bunch of money to get there. But their perspective was this. They actually were in the concert hall when it was happening, and they said that, okay, their perspective was that, and I'm not quoting them directly, but that first of all, like, the first act was Deep Purple, and the artist that introduced Deep Purple was Lars Ulrich from Metallica.
Oh my God.
And Lars Ulrich is known as something of a douchebag and like a jerk. Well, it turns out his intro was fantastic and heartfelt and really thought out. And it kind of, you know, really showed the connection between him and the band. And then later, Kid Rock introduced Cheap Trick. And that was like, they were not expecting anything from Kid Rock. They were going to hate him. But he apparently was really funny and also spoke to his affiliation, you know, or love of the band. And like Kendrick Lamar did the intro for NWA, and that was really good. What they heard from the Black Keys intro of Steve Miller, which I think Steve Miller was the second band, was that they started out their speech with, while doing research for this, we found out all these things. And so they thought, oh, these guys don't even know Steve Miller. They went on Wikipedia and are, like, presenting facts. So their perspective, this is Pardo and Pat Francis, where it was that, you know, so these guys in the Black Keys, who may be fine musicians, don't really have any connection with Steve Miller, and were just doing, you know, a presentation, which is fine, but they didn't see it as very heartfelt. So I read their actual, the transcript of their speech, and it was fine, but yeah, it was kind of pretty canned. And then I saw there's a video on YouTube where you can see all of this on YouTube, I think, in parts, but, there was Steve Miller's acceptance speech, and that actually was really pretty tame, very, you know, thoughtful. He's like thanking the people in his life and the band members who made his career possible. By the way, this was an induction for Steve Miller, not for the Steve Miller band.
Just him?
That becomes important later.
Okay.
And at the end of it, the only thing he really said that was controversial is at the end of it, he said that, you know, one of the things he really wanted to say is that the Hall of Fame should be more inclusive of women. They should be more transparent to the public. And they need to do more to keep music in schools. And then he said, thank you. And so we're here to play some music. And that's when they went and they played their three songs like they're supposed to. And so the Black Eyed Keys in there, or not Black Eyed Keys.
Wow.
The Black Keys guys talked about how, you know, in retrospect, they thought that Steve Miller was a big hypocrite because, you know, the Steve Miller band has been around for 35 years and he's had no women in his band. So what is he talking about? Well, we'll get to that. But all of Steve Miller's controversial statements happened after when he went to the press room backstage. And the reporter started asking him about the whole thing, and he was obviously kind of irritated, and so he acted like that. And his quotes were, he didn't know why he was nominated, because he said for the last 30 years, he doesn't get along with the people that run the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He doesn't like them. He didn't really want their award. When he found out about it, he said it was like a fucking reality TV show. And he said the whole thing was pretty overwhelming because it was a lazy kind of night with a bunch of fat cats at a dinner table, and it wasn't really pleasant. And then he mentioned how they make it really difficult for the audience, for the artists. The reason is because they make it really difficult for the artists. I think it's time for the people running this to turn it over to new people because it doesn't need to be this difficult. You don't need to insult every artist that comes along. People in the crews are nice, but the people running at the top have no concept of how to run a concert or how to run an award ceremony or how to take care of artists. And he went on in a different interview, but in the same setting. He's like, you know, they need to get their legal work straight. They need to respect the artists they say they're honoring, which they don't. He didn't have any of his paperwork signed. He has no licensing agreements with them. They're trying to steal footage from him. They're trying to make him indemnify them from that. When they invited him, telling he was being inducted, they said, here are two tickets, like one for you, one for your wife. If you want tickets for any other tickets to the artist section, like for your bandmates and their wives, it's $10,000 a ticket to be in that room.
Wow.
Not in the concert hall, but like in the big dinner, the artist dinner beforehand. $10,000 a ticket. And, you know, so he's like, well, that's really unpleasant. So when the Black Keys talk about how Steve Miller didn't really want to be there, well, that kind of makes sense. You know, he basically said, look, I did it for the fans, you know, because this is a big deal for my fans that I'm getting in here. So I will do that. But I'm not going to make this easy for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they are douches. So I can see both perspectives here. But then I did a little digging about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And there are three points to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that people don't like. And they are these. The biggest thing is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is run by people who are not musicians. Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner, former Foundation director Susan Evans and writer Dave Marsh, like, started the whole thing. And that's, they're also the people that are in charge of the nomination process. And the nomination process is on purpose not transparent. It's a mystery to outsiders and other artists why some of these things are like for instance, there are a whole bunch of different genres of what you consider rock that just get overlooked. Let's see, they mention prog rock is not really well represented. 60s top 40, New Orleans funk, and then a whole lot of black music, they say. In fact, in 2007, there was some sort of a little bit of controversy because it was, so it was 2007. Roger Friedman of Fox News published an article claiming that the Dave Clark Five should have been the fifth inductee. There were only five inductees that year, that they had more votes, the Dave Clark Five did, than Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. But because Jan Wenner said, well, we've already gone a whole bunch of years with no rap acts, so we need to figure out a way to make sure a rap act gets in this five. And so they basically just kind of fixed the vote so that Grandmaster Flash took out that fifth spot. Dave Clark had to get it another year. So that already kind of burns people. And then the fact that when you are inducted, you know, you basically, they say, okay, you know, here's this thing. You're going to come here. And we like you to do this, and you're not going to get paid. In fact, we're going to actually give you two free tickets, but if you want to bring anybody else, it's going to cost a shit ton more money for you. Like, they have a show to run. Like, it's a business. I understand that, you know, this is a museum. So a museum is a business, and they have to curate the whole thing. And they don't, you know, you don't represent, like, all of rock and roll. Nothing could do that. But I can kind of see Steve Miller's point on some of this, that, you know, so, you know, I'll come here and I'll play my three songs, and the crowd really liked it. It was great. Everybody seemed to enjoy it. Everybody said that. But when reporters, who, by the way, Jimmy Pardo and Pat Francis said the reporters in that room were the most joyless people they had ever seen. Like, they were so happy to be there, Pardo and Francis were. They're like, they were around musical legends, but these reporters were like, you know, like, just did not seem to have any joy in their heart at all. Like, maybe they should have given up that assignment for somebody who would really appreciate being there.
Like a college radio.
Yeah, or just somebody else in the organization who might, oh, I don't know, like Chicago or like, you know, NWA or something. Like, NWA didn't even perform because they weren't going to get to perform the way they wanted to. There's also a controversy about, like, if, like, Chicago, there are only certain members of Chicago were allowed to play with the band themselves, because if you had, like, if you weren't an original member or you hadn't been in the band for so long, you weren't considered part of the group being inducted. Sort of like, you know, Kiss had this controversy about whether, you know, ideally Kiss would be inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the four founding members of Kiss would be up there. But Kiss doesn't tour with the four founding members because two of them hate the other two. So, you know, that's all very complicated. So, you know, it seems like these artists are just, you know, too big time to go do something for the fans. But tickets to, you know, the cheapest ticket to the actual, like, concert and show was, like, $250. So this was a rock concert. And, you know, and if they didn't really pay the artists, and they're expecting to get all this, you know, stuff, like, for free, that otherwise other people would have to pay for to put in their museum, which charges ticket money to get in there. You can kind of see how Steve Miller, being a 73-year-old grumpy old man, would be, like, irritated by a bunch of young kids who don't know shit from Shinola. So there's no excuse for him being rude to the Black Keys. There's no excuse for him to be, like, a jerk. But nothing that I could see in video that he said was anything. Like, he didn't go off like a crazy person. He just announced things. Oh, the other two parts of it, by the way. The thing about the diversity, about women, is there's something like 700 people total, 200 and something groups that have been inducted. And it's like 4% are women. I mean, it's pretty underrepresented, You know, when you consider all of the acts that could be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame who are women or have women in them.
Yeah.
So anyway, and the whole thing is a popularity contest driven by a for-profit business who is also putting on a show every year.
Yeah, it seemed like a big money grab.
Yeah, yeah. But not a big money grab for the artists. And, no. And the Black Keys said they went and did it for free. Like, that was one of the things. Is like, well, they went and they volunteered their time because they thought it would be cool. And whether or not, there was suspicion that, well, okay, their PR people thought it would be pretty cool. Their record label thought it would be pretty cool if they, you know, did this. But even if they themselves just wanted to do it, you know, they shouldn't do it for free either. I mean, if people are making money on this thing, you know, yeah. This whole thing, it may even be a nonprofit organization, but there is money involved.
Well, nonprofit doesn't mean you don't make money. It just means try and spend as much as you make.
Yeah. So anyway,
easy to do.
Yeah. I live a nonprofit lifestyle. That's for sure. but so, you know, that's the thing is that I was happy that you shared it because, you know, my first gut reaction was like, okay, old man yells at cloud. And also, you know, I don't know, you know, don't be a jerk. I mean, there's no excuse for being rude. But there's also a point where, of course, both the, you know, Steve Miller is a raving madman and the Black Keys like, well, we're terribly embarrassed to be part of this now that we're linked to Steve Miller. Those were all articles printed on the Rolling Stone. Yeah. Jan Winters magazine.
Well, there you go.
So Jan Winters magazine.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. So this could all be
this a PR gigantic crap.
PR thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's disappointing. I feel more educated now.
Okay. Well, just wanted to, and like I said, you know, I think certainly our family, you know, heard all those hits from 74 to 77. And then a little bit after that, gonna reach out and grab ya from Steve Miller. But, you know, it's not like Steve Miller is the Rolling Stones either. I mean, what did he do past like 1985? I don't know. You know, yet, should he be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Freaking yeah. I mean, he and Buzz Skaggs started a band when they were 12. And, you know, I mean, he has all the credit to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I didn't honestly know he was still alive.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. Like, and again, what has he done since, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, what has he had to do?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but now...
Besides, you know, as I said, that niche is now filled by Dave Matthews, so...
Well, and now the music industry is different, and I guess maybe iTunes, you can still buy, you know, Steve Miller Greatest Hits albums and make money that way, but I think the most money is going to be made in, like, using your music for advertising, because nobody, you know, buys CDs anymore. So, and how much money are the artists, you know, those artists, how much money are they actually making? Even if they owned all of their own songs, which they probably don't, you know, do they still get royalties? Maybe some, but not probably a ton. I mean, even, like, radio stations, terrestrial radio, I don't think has to pay as big royalties as they used to because there's not as much audience.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah. Anyway, so I don't know. I don't really know anything about the music industry other than what I read in Jan Winter. Sorry, Edgar Winter's brother. No, sorry.
Wow.
That's my Frankenstein.
It's not a very good Frankenstein, Eric.
You shut up, Drew. Yeah. So that's us, I think.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.